Hey friends, thanks for joining me for this episode of Fresh Bites, where we chat with rising stars in our community and hear new ideas and concepts to working with aggression in dogs. I have the pleasure of having a great conversation with Pine Irwin in this episode about determining outcomes in aggression cases and realistic expectations formed through using objective measures. Because let's face it, there's a lot of emotion swirling around with all the humans involved in an aggression case, including the dog's guardians, trainers, veterinarians, rescue or shelter teams, and everyone else that might be involved in the case. So decisions can often be difficult to make and filled with subjectivity. I think you'll get some nice takeaways from this episode with Pine. And if you are working with aggression cases or plan on taking aggression cases as a trainer, or maybe even struggling with your own dog, we have a variety of educational opportunities for you, including the upcoming Aggression in Dogs Conference happening from September 30th through October 2nd, 2022 in Providence, Rhode Island, with both in-person and online options. You can also learn more about the Aggression in Dogs Master Course, which is the most comprehensive course available anywhere in the world for learning how to work with and help dogs with aggression issues by going to aggressivedog.com. Hey guys, I've got a real special guest this week where we're going to unpack the notion that you can save all dogs regardless of their behavior. So let me tell you a little bit about Pine Irwin, who is a certified dog trainer and behavior specialist based in Idaho. He comes from a long line of animal lovers with a grandfather who was a veterinarian. And having been raised on a horse farm, Pine took an early interest in working with animals through horses and then the family German Shepherd after he found a book on making dog agility equipment in the public library. He became interested in behavior when 14 years ago he adopted an Aussie with serious aggression issues that led him to understanding behavior, drive, and motivators in a way he had never thought of before. He has since engaged in experimenting with applying force-free training techniques to feral Mustangs, amorous ducks bent on engaging in aggressive displays of romance with human caretakers, and the more than occasional semi-feral dog caught in a live trap after being dumped in wilderness locations. Pine specializes in dealing with aggression and the weird stuff that pops up in working with animals. Pine is the head of the behavior department and dog end of a rescue organization that deals with abandoned and neglected animals in southern Idaho. He works as a consultant with the HSUS, local rescue organizations, and colleagues who are foolish enough to give unfettered access to his Facebook and cell phone. So welcome, Pine. I'm real excited to be getting into this conversation with you.
So am I. I'm really excited to be here. This is pretty awesome for me from my perspective. I think we all kind of look to you in particular, Mike, as a sort of bastion of aggression behavior stuff. So it's really exciting to be here.
I really appreciate that. And I think one of the things that we can share in this conversation is we're both coming from the perspective or lens of training and behavior consulting, but we also have backgrounds in rescue and the weird cases I was just mentioning. So there's a lot I'm sure we can talk about, but let's get into that initial notion, all dogs can be saved, save them all, the no kill movement as well, and all of those notions and this sort of black and white decision-making process that's creeped into how we look at dogs and how we might work with dogs and make decisions on the ultimate outcome. And especially in aggression cases, I'm sure you're seeing the same thing, is that it is not black and white. There's so many variables to consider when we are looking at the outcome or decisions that can be made for a dog in their future. So perhaps we can jump right into the prognosis in aggression cases and the variables we might look at. So what are your thoughts there and the types of components or variables you might look at in an aggression case?
First and foremost, I kind of look at the dog's living environment. I look at what is available in terms of management strategies. When you're dealing with a dog with aggression issues, that is like paramount, right? It's the management of the behavior while we're attempting to implement some kind of plan to help curb that behavior or change that behavior and that emotion. It's driving it. So that's like my first thing is if I'm dealing with a dog who's got serious aggression issues towards small children and he lives in a house with 10 children under the age of 10 or something like that, that's going to change how I feel about his prognosis versus a dog with small children aggression issues in a house where there might be a small kid once in a while, a grandkid visiting. There's big difference in between those two management strategies. beyond management and things in the living environment, I look at the dogs, you know, the owner, the guardians, I guess is how I would like to say it. I try to say it now. Is this idea of, are these the kind of people who have the mental bandwidth and the resources to put forth all the effort that is going to be required to fix, quote unquote, this individual case? Or are these the kind of people who are looking for a quick answer? They want me to do something now, solve the problem, and not, you know, and not have to worry about it down the road, you know? And those are two different types of guardians, and the prognosis for the dogs in those environments is going to be radically different. If they're not the type to put forth the effort, then you're wasting your money having me come in, because nothing I tell you is going to fix the problem overnight. It just doesn't work that way.
So what about risk assessment? Do you also consider that in the overall outlook? Bite history, size of dog, you know, what the dog has done, where the dog is biting, all those variables?
I do. And I take a pretty detailed case history, and then I do a detailed consult before I start any kind of training. There's like an hour and a half period where I just sit down with the owners and like we go over everything that I can possibly think of. You know, not all bite histories are created equal. A dog who bit someone with a level one bite versus a level three bite, there's obviously a very different, you know, level of aggression in that behavior, but there's also variables within that. I know a dog who has a level three bite, and she's the sweetest, most wonderful dog. Now, she's amazing. You would never know that that had happened in her past, but the situation that led up to that experience basically primed the pump and steered her right towards it. Whereas I've met dogs with only level one bites where I was just like, oh, yeah, you're going to be a problem, you know, like because they have never gone to that level of aggression where they've broken skin and required medical intervention, but they're a lot more committed to that action of violence than the dog with the level three bite. So the variables are basically everything when you're working in aggression cases. And I always feel a little bit bad when people contact me and they want to start training right away. And I'm like, yeah, no, we got to just sit and have a conversation first. Because I need to know walking in, if I'm walking into a situation where there's a good prognosis, or I'm walking into a situation where, you know, it's very likely I'm going to get hurt. I like to know those things in advance. So I typically try to assess as many of the variables as I can. Of course, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean I won't walk into a situation and be completely blindsided, but I try not to.
And so you work with a lot of rescues or certainly different organizations that are adopting out animals and making these decisions on what's safe and what's not. So what happens when you're running into this? You know, so you've got we'll use an example of a case, a dog that has a bite history, level three bite history. So, you know, puncture wounds about half the length of the canine tooth. So not very serious damaging bites, but enough of concern.
Yeah.
And just let's say it's a larger-ish dog, two-year-old or something like that. And you've got a rescue that's working with this dog. And they reach out to you for assistance, maybe on behavioral change strategies and things like that. And they ask you, hey, Pine, you know, what do you think about the outcome here? Or they have the mindset that, oh, we're going to totally be able to adopt this dog out. So let's get this dog rehabbed or fixed, big air quotes up there. And we want you to fix this dog. And that's that way we can adopt it out safely. So what are your thoughts, or how do you navigate that conversation?
With the rescue I work with the most, that I'm, you know, kind of on staff and on board for, I will straight up just tell the director what I think. I'm pretty blunt with her, and I'll just be like, yeah, no, this is not going to happen. The reality of the situation is not good. When it's an organization I'm not as familiar with, I try to be pretty honest without being super mean about it, I guess. It's not my job. I never tell a client, like, I think you should euthanize this dog. I never recommend a client rehome a dog. I firmly am entrenched in this philosophy of if you're in, I'm in. So if you want to fight the good fight, I will fight it alongside of you. I don't care how long it takes. I don't care how difficult it is. I don't care how many times I have to go to a Michael Chicasio dog aggression conference to try to learn more. I don't care. I'm in if you're in. Obviously, you know, that does require a little bit of monetary compensation for that. But, you know, I won't ever recommend to a client, like, this is a no-go situation. This is not going to work. I will just keep trying. With a rescue, I feel it's a little bit different because they're not the ones who are going to own the dog, right? Ultimately, someone else is going to own the dog. So I would look at the dog with the level 3 bite history, and I would look at the incident in which that happened. If it's been multiple incidents, I feel a little more strongly about trying to be like, probably, maybe not. If it's a single incident, you know, I feel like reading up to that situation. So in the situation that I think of with that level 3 bite, it involved children. And it involved children being kind of mean to the dog to start with. And so the recommendation is that this dog just does not go to a home with small children, period. No one under the age of 10 or 12, actually, I think is where we cut it off with her. You know, if there's anyone in and out of the house on a frequent and consistent basis is under the age of 12, it's just not a go situation for adoption because it's not worth the risk, right? You know, in another rescue, I might not be as straightforward, but I would write my assessment. And basically it would say like, these are the recommendations for the home that you're looking for. And if I truly feel very strongly that this dog is not adoptable, my list of recommendations for the home you're looking for is going to get super specific. Just as a means of like, no, really, all of these boxes need to be checked before you could even consider it. Is this really something you want to go forward with? Is this dog really malleable enough or to be placed into a modern home environment? If what you're looking for is some weird guy living in the middle of the woods in a shack who never has any company, you know, what are the odds that that guy is looking for this dog, you know, and doesn't have any other dogs or any other animals or anyone ever come and visit, you know, and is that someone you actually want to interact with? Because that might be interesting too. So it's those kind of environments. So I try really hard not to be the person who rolls up into the situation and says, yeah, we shouldn't do this. This is a no-go. With the rescue that I work with all the time, I'll flat out just tell them like, nope, we should not. We do not want to invite this into our fold, but that I feel a personal responsibility as someone who's a part of that organization to kind of protect our volunteers and protect our adopters and protect our fosters, you know, from this environment. It's tough.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot, especially has to deal with the relationship to do with the relationship you have with that rescue or shelter and how much they trust you or what you're saying to them. But you made an important distinction as well is the difference between an owned dog, so a dog that's already been adopted or living with a family versus a dog that is in, we'll call it the custody or the ownership of the rescue or shelter. It's a different kind of situation and the variables when assessing prognosis are much different because of that risk. But the interesting thing for me is that some rescues and shelters that I've worked with are more apt to have less risk, or I should say they are more risk tolerant. In other words, they're more likely to say, okay, this dog is not owned by anybody. Let's find that home to see if we can give this dog a chance. And it's a struggle, right? Because they're looking to find homes for the dogs, obviously, and also balance that need for safety and the risk part of it. And so it might be, in a sense, different in terms of the overall decision-making process for the dog's future, because then they don't have to live with that animal. They've given it to somebody else to live with and make those decisions. So what are your thoughts there?
I feel like for the most part, barring really unethical rescues that are out there, and there are some, I feel for the most part, rescues aren't looking at so much as passing the problem on as they're trying desperately to help animals. I think their hearts are usually in the right place. I just don't always think their brains are a part of that. I feel like my job when I sign off on whether or not this dog is adoptable is to ensure that, you know, barring extreme circumstance, this dog is pretty safe, you know, as safe as a dog can be. I don't feel like it's okay to pass that buck if I don't think that dog is safe. You know, it's one thing. We had a dog with us for like a year and a half who was extremely dog aggressive and straight up homicidal with small animals. And I was like, this is going to be a tough one. But we found him a place eventually. And that was amazing. And he's doing well and he's thriving. I got him to a point where he no longer wanted to objectively, you know, commit crimes against animals when he was walking down the street. And that made it to the point where we just had to wait. But there are other dogs that come through where I'm just like, realistically, the prognosis here is not good. I think, like I said, I think rescues have their hearts in the right place and their brains just aren't thinking about it. And it's a liability, right? If we adopt out a dog and he maims someone or kills another animal or something like that, guess who they're going to blame? They're not going to go, you know, well, the owner didn't follow the protocol that we put in place, which was absolutely do not introduce them to any small children or small dogs or small animals. They're going to be like, well, why did the rescue adopt out this aggressive, quote unquote, aggressive dog? And then the flip side of that is, of course, on social media, you have all those cases where rescues do euthanize dogs for serious aggression behaviors and everyone crucifies them. Well, why didn't you find this? Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you do this? And it's just not that easy to find someone, you know, a year and a half for a dog to basically sit in holding. We couldn't even place him in a foster home because, of course, all of our fosters have other animals. He's sweet as can be with humans, which was his saving grace. But it was just like the people who are qualified to deal with dogs with serious aggression issues, our houses are full. I'm sure your house is full. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah. And I do want to empathize with the rescues and the shelters that are out there in the world trying to do the best they can, because that's really what it is. Nobody's getting into this because they want to do the opposite. They're getting in to help the dogs, and it can be very difficult decisions. And one of the conundrums is when there's this sort of viewpoint of behavior where we can turn it on and off like a light switch, sort of like I'm going to say, hey, Pine, I've got this dog, take the dog, foster it for 3 weeks and fix it. Almost like it's like a dislocated joint. So we can just pop back into place and life's going to go on as normal in most cases. And unfortunately, that's the misunderstanding of behavior sometimes. And so as I was going along in the rescue world and learning more about dogs and fostering dogs with aggression issues, I at first had the same mindset. I said, yeah, we can absolutely fix all these dogs. And, you know, I've watched a few episodes of The Dog Whisperer and I can apply some training strategies I learned on that show. And next thing you know, the harsh reality comes slapping you in the face of like saying, okay, this is not how behavior works. And so you were talking, before we jumped on this recording, you were talking about, you know, the healthy side of a dog or the health, when we're talking about just health in general, and how we don't often think about behavior as part of that health picture. So can you expand more on that?
Yeah. I think it's a cultural thing, and I think it transcends dogs. We do that with humans too. We assume because the body is healthy that this animal is healthy. And the reality is the mind is a part of the body. And when the mind's not healthy and it's devolved into developing maladaptive behaviors and things like that, we're not dealing with a healthy animal anymore. We don't necessarily, I have PTSD as full disclosure and ADHD, which is a potent combination. My brain, I'm the first person to make the joke that my brain is broken and my brain is not optional. It's not. Like I have very serious problems that I have to deal with on a consistent basis, on a daily basis. I went to therapy for like 900 years. I should probably still be in therapy. Like, let's be real. I think everybody should mostly. But my brain is not healthy. It has maladaptive coping mechanisms that I have had to work very hard at and still have to work very hard at to manage and to recognize and address as they come up. Dogs are much the same way. Animals are much the same way when the mind is unhealthy. And we have, at least in the modern end of dog training, really gotten comfortable saying like, yeah, you should maybe see a vet behaviorist about that. Have you thought about meds? But I think a lot of dog training is still really far behind that. And a lot of clients are still really resistant to that. And I think that's probably reflective of how we treat people who take mental health medication. You know, they're like, well, I don't want my dog to be a zombie. I don't want my dog to be this. And I'm like, well, currently your dog is an anxious mess who is attempting to kill your neighbor every single day. Is a zombie that much worse than the current situation he's living in? And I think of it from the animal's perspective that that's not a healthy brain and that's not a healthy mindset to constantly be anxious about everything. Every noise that goes off, every movement outside the window sets this dog into a tailspin of aggressive behavior that redirects onto other animals or other people or whatever. I'm like, that's not healthy. Like, yeah, that dog's body might be perfectly healthy. You know, he doesn't have any obvious underlying signs of medical issues, but he's not healthy. You know, his mind is not healthy. And anybody who's existed in any sort of state of stress for a prolonged period of time can tell you that it's not a healthy way to live. And it definitely has a physical impact at some point. I'm assuming it would with dogs too. Haven't read a study on it, but it's probably out there coming somewhere, hopefully.
So you have a very unique perspective and a very understanding one, because what you're going through or have been through is going to give you much, seeing it through the dog's eyes is what I'm kind of, the words I'm looking for. So have you taken that aspect and used it in a way to communicate to clients so they can better understand? Or do you have like a certain analogy you use with clients that if their dog is experiencing, things that you're seeing as beyond just, a normal aggressive response to a threatening stimulus, for instance?
Yeah. Usually the first one I default to is I'm like, when you have a really bad, stressful day, you come home and crack open a bottle of wine. What does your dog get to do? And that usually sets the light bulb, like starts to turn the light on, where they're like, oh, my dog doesn't have the option to pour himself a glass of wine to decompress and deal with his stress, right? Like he doesn't have that option. And it was like, you have a stressful day at work. You get to go out with your friends and go to the bar and have a nice meal or whatever to decompress and vent and do all those things that we do as coping mechanisms for our stress. Some people exercise, some people, take up knitting or whatever it is. But your dog, what does your dog get to do when they're overwhelmed by their emotions and their feelings and their circumstance? And it's interesting because people are almost always willing to attribute dogs to having positive emotions, right? Oh, my dog loves me. My dog loves this. My dog is happy when we do this, X, Y, and Z. But they're really reluctant to give them that same grace towards what we would consider negative emotions, like fear, dislike, anger, and those kind of things. And we attribute those things to some sort of like personal grudge from the dog. And it's bizarre how that happens, because it's not. It's, if an animal can feel joy and happiness and love, then by extension, they can feel the opposite of those things, right? It's just like, that's how brains work. If you can get one, you can get the other. And it's weird that we're not willing to attribute those things. We tend to take those things personally, right? Like, well, my dog's just being this, he's being dominant, he's being spiteful, he's being all these other, and he's just a jerk, he's just all these other things. And I'm like, your dog is dealing with some pretty intense emotions. We do it with children. You see it with kids too. People are like, my kid's acting out, he's just being a jerk. A therapist walks in and goes, yeah, so your kid's got some like pretty serious anxiety here, and it's manifesting, or it has, he or she has ADHD and it's manifesting as like anger and aggression and things like that, which is what happened with me as a kid. My ADHD was undiagnosed. I wasn't properly treated and I didn't get the proper therapies and things like that, the training, quote unquote, that I needed to help manage that. And so I had been labeled, combative and difficult. I wasn't either of those things. I was dealing with some stuff and nobody was helping. No adults were helping me. And so as owners and guardians, you're the adult in this situation. And you need to roll up into that situation and attribute that your dog's feelings are both A, legitimate, and B, need help with. They're small children in that element. They've got the cognitive capacity of the average 2 to 3-year-old. You can't just roll up in there and tell them to stop feeling that way. Don't do that. It's embarrassing. It's difficult. It makes my life hard. You have to address that as the emotion that it is and treat it as the emotion that it is instead of just attributing it to whatever.
You bring up so many great points there, and especially again from your unique perspective and being able to see it through that lens. And so we're going to take a quick break here and not grab a glass of wine or a full bottle, but we're going to take a short break and we'll be back to talk more about the labels that you were just mentioning and how quick we are to label dogs in some cases. So we'll be back in just a moment after a word from our sponsor. Hey friends, it's me again, and I hope you are enjoying this episode. You may have figured out that something I deeply care about is helping dogs with aggression issues live less stressful, less confined, more enriched and overall happy lives with their guardians. Aggression is so often misunderstood, and we can change that through continued education, like we receive from so many of the wonderful guests on this podcast. In addition to the podcast, I have two other opportunities for anyone looking to learn more about helping dogs with aggression issues, which include the Aggression in Dogs Master Course and the Aggression in Dogs Conference. If you want to learn more about the most comprehensive course on aggression taught anywhere in the world, head on over to aggressivedog.com and click on the Dog Pros tab and then the Master Course. The course gives you access to 23 modules on everything from assessment to safety to medical issues to the behavior change plans we often use in a number of different cases, including lessons taught by Dr. Chris Pockel, Kim Brophy, and Jessica Dolce. You also receive access to a private Facebook group with over 1,000 of your fellow colleagues and dog pros all working with aggression cases. After you finish the course, you also gain access to private, live group mentor sessions with me, where we practice working through a variety of cases together. And if you need CEUs, we've got you covered. We are approved for just about every major training and behavior credential out there. This is truly the flagship course offered on aggression in dogs, and is perfect for pet pros that want to set themselves apart and take their knowledge and expertise to the next level, or even for pet owners who are seeking information to help their own dog. And don't forget to join me for the third annual Aggression in Dogs Conference, either in person or online, from Providence, Rhode Island on September 30th through October 2nd, 2022. This year's lineup includes many of the amazing guests you might have heard on the podcast, including Suzanne Clothier, Jen Triock, Simone Mueller, Dr. Amber Batson, Kim Brophy, Karishma War, Laura Monaco Torelli, Dr. Simone Gabois, and many more. Head on over to aggressivedog.com and click on the Conference tab to learn more about the exciting agenda on everything from advanced concepts and leash reactivity to using positive reinforcement to work with predatory behavior. And if you like to show off your support of the podcast, this year we teamed up again with the folks over at Wolf Culture for some catchy, limited-run conference merchandise. Wolf Culture is known for their witty, nerdy, and no-nonsense apparel that was created in 2019 to spread more awareness towards the use of humane training methods. Their apparel is here to help you start conversations, advocate for your animals, and rep force-free training in a different way. So don't forget to get your conference gear. It leaves the site after 12/31/2022. If you want 10% off your order, use the code BITEY10 at checkout. That's BITEY10. All right, welcome back, everybody. Back here with Pine Irwin. And now we're going to talk about some of the labels that we use with aggression and reactivity, and sometimes we're quick to jump to certain labels. And the point you were making just before we took a break is so salient, because oftentimes we can do that with people too, right? We're quick to label somebody into a certain category of behavior, or, you know, giving them some sort of personality trait with just some blanket statement that could really have a profound impact in how we're working on the behavior change strategy, or how we even might understand it. So, you know, aggressive is certainly a common label we might be quick to give dogs, but you actually tend to try to avoid that when possible. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't like labeling dogs aggressive. I'm not saying there are no aggressive dogs out there. I have met maybe three. I've been doing this for about 10 years, and I've met three dogs that I would be like, yeah, he'd mess you up just for the heck of it, you know, just because it was Tuesday and it might be fun. One of which was my Aussie, actually. But for the most part, when dealing with dogs with aggressive behavior, I try to couch it as aggressive behavior. It is behavior that is serving some kind of function for the dog. Typically, that function is get away from me, right? 99% of aggression cases are dealing with a dog who really genuinely dislikes something, either because it's a fear response or it's just really uncomfortable and unpleasant in other ways for them, that's where the aggression comes from. It comes from this function of behavior. So I don't like to label dogs aggressive. I label dogs with aggressive behavior towards X, whatever it is. I feel like words are important, and how we frame things in both the way we speak and the way we diagnose and the way we treat is really important in terms of keeping that perspective of empathy. Something I like to tell clients is that behavior is not personal. Your dog does not try to eat the mailman because he personally hates the mailman, or because he's trying to embarrass you, or because he's trying to make your life difficult. He tries to eat the mailman because he's incredibly uncomfortable with this strange dude with large packages rolling up to your front of your house and dropping stuff and then leaving. He just doesn't like that. He's very uncomfortable. He's very nervous about it. And so he's dealt with it by behaving very aggressively at the window or the door. From his perspective, it works, right? The guy never breaks in. He just leaves his stuff and runs away. So I don't like to label dogs or any animal as aggressive. I like to label behavior. I see aggressive behavior. I see fearful behavior. I see over-aroused behavior and things like that. You know, your dog is not evil. He's not mean. He's not aggressive towards these things. By and large, like I said, there are exceptions to the rule. But he is, you know, experiencing a great deal of an overload of an emotional response that is triggering aggressive behavior. It's not personal. It doesn't have anything to do with you as a guardian. It's everything to do with them and their emotional response to whatever triggered it.
Yeah. Again, going back to your childhood, you know, there's so many parallels in what you were just talking about through your own experiences and how you're able to, again, communicate that to owners or to your clients in a certain way must be extremely helpful for conveying that point. Because as a child, we could be labeled something like that child's being stubborn or disobedient or willful or spiteful and all these things that we might apply to dogs in the same way, but nobody's, you know, asking, what's the motivation for that? What's the underlying emotion? What's the function of that behavior? Why is that person or dog displaying this undesirable behavior that we're observing? It's undesirable to the person that's observing it or experiencing it. And nobody's asking that question a lot of times. So, and I really appreciate that you're sharing that perspective in, you know, something that many of us may not experience or have the same unique outlook on. So,
well, if the dog is stubborn, if the dog is willful, if the child is stubborn, if the child is willful and et cetera, it takes all responsibility away for us to deal with it, right? It's their problem. They should just get over it and get beyond it and stop doing this. And, you know, best case scenario, we ignore them and we ignore those needs and let them escalate. Worst case scenario, they start dealing with it in equally aggressive fashions that, of course, escalate the scenario even faster. It just takes away our responsibility if we label the animal or the kid or whatever as they're the problem, instead of their emotional response to a trigger is causing all of these problems, and we should deal with that emotional response, and that'll by default erase all these behaviors that we don't like, right? Because they won't feel the need to escalate to those levels.
So I want to switch gears here a little bit now, because you and I were chatting again before the show and talking about sort of the weird cases. You know, you and I both enjoy getting cases referred to us or that have like a real unique aspect or something that you don't normally see. Especially for me, I love the aggression cases in which there's some strange behavior going on. You know, example is like generalized guarding. It could be somebody just, you know, leaning to reach down to grab something they just dropped, and the dog thinks, oh no, they're about to take a resource away from me. So it's generalized to basically anything that person does, any movements towards the floor, anything like that. It's, you know, it's going to trigger that aggressive response in the dog. So cases like that, can you think of something off the top of your mind that you've experienced lately, or maybe in the past, that's sort of in that weird, you know, air quotes?
Well, I think case? The duck was probably my most recent, like it was last year, and weirdest case, because it was weird and delightful. I love weird. I think of it as a puzzle that I get to solve. I get to sit down and look at all the pieces and gather as many pieces and elements and variables as I can, and then solve the puzzle, right? How do we get this to a situation that is livable? So the duck was a Muscovy duck, which is actually not a duck. It's a duck adjacent species. So they're kind of like donkeys are to horses, I guess, which I didn't know until I started researching Muscovy ducks. I got a call at 8 o'clock in the morning from the rescue. They have a ton of ducks that had been abandoned. And so they've taken them in, you know, because they're not equipped to survive in the quote unquote wild. And this duck was aggressively attacking one of the gals who works there while she was out trying to tend all of these creatures, ducks, chickens, turkeys, rabbits. There was a pig briefly. And so it was, I was like, what do you mean attacking? And he was literally running up behind her and biting her at the back of her knees and like humping her leg, for lack of a better description. But he's not a small duck. He was quite large in terms of duck size. And the Muscovy actually has a point on their beak that allows them to grab things and hold on. And he was doing damage even through her clothes and through her like jeans and stuff. He was like actually putting bruises and breaking skin a little bit. So I got a call from the director and she was like, can you fix a duck? And I was like, I don't know. Let's go find out. So I did some research really quick on things that ducks really liked, and Muscovy ducks in particular. And I rolled up there and just went to work. It was early spring, so it was right around this time. And it was basically a reaction to he was in love with the gal, and like madly in love with her. And ducks, as most people who have any sort of experience with them know, that their romantic affections are quite aggressive. This is a really nice way to put it. It's downright, it's physical assault. it's really not great. And so he was just like, he was really adamant that he was going to be like, they were going to have babies is what he was adamant about, which obviously is problematic. So we went to work and we figured out that he was so overwhelmed by his hormones that we couldn't really convince him to take any sort of reliable reward, except that he was a duck who'd been hand raised clearly, and he was super into human interaction. He'd imprinted on people and he was really into human interaction. So basically we made it contingent that the reward was, is the humans will interact with you, they will engage with you if you can control yourself. If you're not controlling yourself, then you don't get to have any, we will, you know, ignore you. There was some defensive handling stuff that we did. We put some extra thick ski pants on the gal that he was romantically involved with. I have a pair of like cowboy boots that I tend to wear anytime I'm dealing with an animal that likes to bite and use their teeth because they're pretty hard to get through. So I can usually defend myself by sticking a toe in their mouth if I need to. Hopefully I rarely have to, but every once in a while I'm like on the defensive about it. But so and we spent the whole morning doing that. I was there until like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I think, working on it. And by the end of it, he was pretty well controlled. But what we also did is we called the vet, the local avian vet. And we asked about what we could do about, like, is there a way to neuter a duck to remove that hormones? Because I was like, look, we can fix it right now, but I think next spring we're going to be right back here. You know, as soon as those hormones go, we're going to be right back here. And so we worked on it. We talked to the vet. It turns out there's an implant you can get where you can basically, you inject it into the duck and it stops puberty. It halts their hormones. And you can do it for chickens too, like roosters that crow. If you've got them in like an urban environment where the neighbors are complaining, apparently you can give it to them too and they won't crow. It was a really cool thing to discover. So we had the vet special order it. We gave him the injection, never had a problem. This spring, I did not get it. He was adopted. I did not get a call this spring that he had decided to, you know, amorously aggress onto his adopters, who he's very fond of and he likes them. They constantly tell us that he's very dog-like. You know, he comes when he's called and he's, you know, and it was really interesting. It was a fascinating case because I rolled up into it like, I guess we'll see what happens, which is about how I approach most things. I would love to tell you that I'm this wonderful scientist who like keeps detailed records and does all this like, you know, strictly scientific by the book stuff. But the reality is oftentimes when I get a call, I just go, yeah, let's see if we can. I'll try.
That's an awesome story. And I think I just learned more about ducks than I've ever known in my entire life.
It was great to learn. Like I have no use for this knowledge at this point, but I know a lot about ducks now.
The question is if they make a duck-sized break stick from the bite and hold.
I don't know. I was using a broom. I just used a broom to like peel him off of the gal when he would make a mistake. It was a lot of learning on the fly about like duck behavior too, about like what he would do before he would escalate to full on like trying to jump on her. But I learned a heck of a lot about ducks. that I have no use for. Unless you've got a duck, someone out there who's having a problem, give me a call because it was fun.
All right. Duck behavior consultants in your
there
future.
We go.
So Pine, tell us what you're up to and where people can find you.
Currently I am working like a dog, no pun intended, like most of us. I'm located in Idaho. I'm based in Idaho. I do work virtually, which is a lot of fun for me personally. I really enjoy the commute to my office in my back room of my house versus driving all over the place, but I'll drive if I need to. I did put out a thing on my Facebook page the other day that let everybody know that for the cost of my travel expenses, I will go anywhere and do anything. not anything, but I will work on any case. I will give any presentation. I will do anything. If you cover my travel expenses, I like to travel a lot. You can find me online at irwindogtraining.com. It's Irwin with an I, just like Steve Irwin, but we are not sadly related, at least as far as I know. Or you can find me on Facebook, same Irwin Dog Training. My Facebook is pretty active. It's really the best way to reach me, probably. Don't call my phone. I'm a millennial. We hate that. You can text it if you've got my number, but try not to call me unless it's really important. I'm on Instagram at Hikerhund, and that's H-I-K-E-R-H-U-N-D. My Instagram is normally fairly active, and it's a great way to reach me as well. Otherwise, I am available virtually anywhere in the world if you want to reach out. Not hard to find.
Awesome. Well, careful what you wish for, because I'm going to link to all that stuff in the show notes and people are going to be able to find you. So.
Oh, that'll be fun. Send me your weird stuff.
Yes. Duck cases going to Pine.
There we go.
Pine, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the show. It was great talking to you and I hope to see you again in the future.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me in this conversation with Pine and all the amazing insight he shared. If you like the show, please don't forget to subscribe, share, and give a rating. And hop on over to aggressivedog.com for more information about helping dogs with aggression, from the Aggression in Dogs Master Course to webinars from world-renowned experts, and even an annual conference. We have options for both pet pros and pet owners to learn more about aggression in dogs.
We put some extra thick ski pants on the gal that he was romantically involved with.
Thanks for joining me for the Bitey End of the Dog. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe, share, and give a rating. And hop on over to aggressivedog.com or theLooseLeashAcademy.com for more information about webinars, courses, and conferences, all dedicated to helping dogs with aggression issues. And don't forget, the Aggression in Dogs Conference will be happening from October 22nd to 24th with 12 amazing speakers, all streaming from a television studio in Chicago. It's going to be a truly unique event in 2021.